the headlines, Russia's top negotiator in the JCPOA revival talk says Iran's response to the EU draft text on the restoration of the deal is serious. The new border clashes between Azerbaijan and Armenia. Azeri soldiers have died, and the two neighbors blame each other for the latest flare-up. Hamas resistance movement reiterates that Palestinians will continue their struggle against the Israeli occupation until they free their land. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumisha Ahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Russia says Iran's latest response to the EU draft text for the revival of the 2015 deal constitutes no serious obstacle to a final agreement. In a tweet, Moscow's envoy to the talks said the conclusion of the talks depends exclusively on the political will of the participating states. Iran and the U.S. have been corresponding indirectly over the EU proposal. The U.S. claims that Iran's reply was not constructive, while the EU says diverging Tehran-Washington positions have put the revival deal in danger. On Monday, Germany's Chancellor Olaf Scholz has alleged Iran that it did not respond positively to the draft. Tehran, however, says it has not asked for any new demands or raised any issues that could be an obstacle to the agreement. Iran and other signatories to the deal, formerly known as the JCPOA, are now awaiting a formal U.S. response. Washington left the deal in 2018. Tensions are once again flaring between Armenia and Azerbaijan, with the two sides reporting large-scale border clashes that left Azerbaijani troops dead. Armenia's military accused Azerbaijan of launching intensive shelling against its position along the border. It said Azerbaijan had also used drones. Meanwhile, Azerbaijan's defense ministry accused Armenia of, quote, large-scale subversive acts near the border areas. It said its army positions came under fire. Baku says it has suffered losses among its servicemen. However, it did not provide the figure. There have been several outbreaks of violence between the two arch foes since the 2020 war over the disputed enclave of Nagorno-Karabakh. The conflict, which claimed over 6,500 lives on both sides, ended with a Russian brokered ceasefire. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says Palestinians will continue their struggle until they take back their rights and drive the occupiers out of their ancestral land. The group, in a statement, also highlighted the legitimacy of Palestinian resistance against Israeli atrocities. The statement was issued on the 17th anniversary, marking the regime's expulsion from the Gaza Strip. It also condemned Israel's cruel siege of the coastal strip and stressed that the Palestinian nation would not remain silent on the continued blockade. In 2005, Israel withdrew its forces from Gaza in what it called a separation plan. The regime, however, imposed a crippling blockade on the Strip, potentially turning it into an open prison for nearly a million Palestinians. Gazans have repeatedly called on the international community to push for an end to the inhumane siege. Israel has launched a massive campaign of arrests in the occupied West Bank, detaining dozens of Palestinians since Sunday. The arrests have been made during raids in the cities of Jenin and Al-Khalil, Mona Kendall reports.
As part of Israel's months-long so-called Operation Break the Wave, regime forces have arrested dozens of Palestinians during raids across the occupied West Bank since Sunday. This time, the regime intensified its arrest campaign in the cities of Jenin and Al-Khalil. Israeli military issued a statement saying those who were detained are terrorist suspects. The regime conducts night raids in response to a series of anti-Israel operations that led to the killing of 19 Israeli soldiers and settlers earlier this year.
Whatever the Israeli military names its operations, these raids by the Israeli forces as well as by the settlers are an open war against the Palestinian people. The raids are an attempt to break the Palestinians' will to force them to abandon all forms of resistance and to stop fighting for their freedom.
The arrest campaign comes amid aggressive policies practiced by the Israeli prison authorities against thousands of Palestinian prisoners languishing behind Israeli bars. Cancer-stricken prisoner Nasser Abu Hamid, the leader of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades in Ramallah, is in a life-threatening health condition after he fell into a coma. The Palestinian Prisoner Society has warned Abu Hamid is fighting for his life as the Israeli prison service continues to refuse to provide him with necessary medical care. Abu Hamid has been in jail since 2002, serving a life sentence.
We call on all Palestinian groups to mobilize people and hold rallies to express their anger and rejection of the Israeli criminal policies that have led to the deaths of many of Palestinian prisoners. Nasser Abu Hamid is a national hero and a symbol for the Palestinian people. He is literally battling for his life due to his worsening health condition.
According to the Palestinian Prisoners Society, 231 prisoners have died in Israeli jails since 1967.
So on the one hand, detention of Palestinians is on the rise, and on the other hand, torturing and denying prisoners basic human rights is also on the rise. Israel claims these policies are meant to mow the lawn, prevent any forms of resistance, but for Palestinians, these illegal policies are part of Tel Aviv's perpetual war against them. Mona Qandil, Occupy Ramallah.
Moving on to the war between Moscow and Kiev, the Ukrainian army claims it has retaken 500 square kilometers of territory from Russian forces in the south of the country in the past 2 weeks. The army says it has taken full control over several settlements in the Kherson region. Ukraine has also been claiming gains against Russian military in the east. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said his country's forces had recaptured 6,000 square kilometers of territory from Russia this month. Meanwhile, the Kremlin has reiterated that it will achieve its goals of military operation that it launched in Ukraine back in February. European economies have been left in a recession caused by tensions with Russia and rising energy prices. This is what we discussed in our news review program. Welcome to another edition of the news review. Tensions with Russia and rising energy prices are taking their toll on European economies, leaving some in a recession and others on the brink of recession. The UK economy grew more slowly than expected in July, raising the risk that it is already in a recession. The economy had already contracted by 0.1% in the second quarter. The UK inflation is at a 40-year high of more than 10%, prompting a cost-of-living crisis. The situation isn't much better in Europe's biggest economy. A leading think tank has warned that Germany will fall into recession next year as its economy is likely to shrink 0.3%. Inflation there is expected to hit above 8% this year and over 9% next year. Europe's economy is heavily reliant on Russian energy, particularly gas. Moscow has suspended gas deliveries to Europe, citing repairs and blaming the Western sanctions over the war in Ukraine. European officials say Russia is using energy as a weapon. To discuss that further, we're joined by Max Civilli, who has traveled to Berlin, and he's joining us from there, and also Greg Simons, researcher at the Institute for Russian and Eurasian Studies from Sweden. Thanks to both of you gentlemen for joining us. Let's begin with our correspondent Max, who has traveled all the way from Italy to Germany to see how the Europe's biggest economy is doing considering the situation. Give us an update, Max.
Well, there's growing concern in Germany about the energy situation. This despite the reassuring words of the German Chancellor Scholz. Basically, the Chancellor said a few days ago that Germany is prepared to handle a fallout of the crisis, energy crisis, should Russia halt its gas supply. Scholz said that Germany has put in place measures to counter the energy crisis, measures such as a regasification plant, which is being built in Wilhelmshaven in the north of the country, an infrastructure that will provide 7.5 million, billion cubic meters of gas, which is the equivalent of 8% of the total gas demand in Germany. But this has been disputed by the Association of Town and Municipalities, which is a very influential association here in Germany, which represents about 14,000 towns and municipalities across Germany, but also by a number of think tank. There's fear of hacker attack. There's fear of an overload of the power grid that could create a problem. Also, the think tanks, some think tanks have said that tens of thousands of businesses are at risk of going bankrupt. So the situation is very, very complex right now in Germany. There's also been moves to try to save 20% to slash, sorry, power usage by 20% by limiting heating and gas lights. So right now the situation is evolving, is changing, and it will depend very much on what the European Union will decide in the coming hours, in the coming days.
Exactly. So let's bring in Greg Simons from Sweden. Do you think that there will be any change in the policy of the EU regarding Russia, considering that they are paying quite a hefty toll because of the sanctions that they've imposed?
Well, I do not think there will be any change of policy. If there was to be a change of policy, the EU would have to be an independent and sovereign organization that represented European interests. If anything, they have proven time and time again, and this is yet another proof, that they are prepared to sacrifice the rights and lives of European citizens to please American geostrategic imperatives.
Thank you very much. So, Max, back to you. Do you think, how will the public react, considering the fact that the situation is getting tougher and tougher?
Well, of course, I had the chance to have a stroll in the center of Berlin today and talk to the people from Berlin, and they don't really know much about the situation, about the dynamics behind the scene. What they know is that the main point of contention is the European Union, the European Commission's proposal to place a price cap on Russian gas supplies. That's a common thing they know, and so one of the most disputed thing, considering that some countries like Hungary, like Slovakia, like Austria, which are heavily reliant on Russian supply, have repeatedly warned that Russia could respond to a price cap by simply cutting off gas supply, and this is something that also President Putin has indicated in the past.
So, Mr. Simons, is it even possible for Europe not to be dependent on Russian energy?
In the short to medium term, no. I mean, both Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates both stated that Europe is dependent on Russian energy. And I mean, they don't have any, any stake in this. They just pointed the obvious. I've heard the same thing in private conversations in Romania, that the more sober assessments in private, because what's said in private and what's said in public are two different things. In public, it's okay, save energy and hurt Putin. But what's said in private is that the system will not function. It'll start to collapse. And we can already see signs of this even before winter really sets in.
Thank you very much. Greg Simons, researcher at the Institute for Russian and Eurasian Studies from Sweden, and also Max Civilli, our correspondent who has traveled from Italy to Germany, the European biggest economy, to give us updates there. Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen.
The death of Queen Elizabeth II has brought renewed focus on the British royal family's life of privilege and affluence at a time when millions of Britons are struggling to get by in the face of record economic uncertainty and deepening energy crisis. From London, Said Puraza reports.
Public expressions of grief for the death of the Queen by those who see the royals as a glamorous family contributing millions of dollars into the UK economy each year, for instance, in tourism revenues. But that sentiment seems to be changing with growing calls for Britain to become a republic. The reasons for that transformation vary, but one argument used on both sides of the divide is money, taxpayer money, more than $130 million of it, granted by the British government to the royal family, covering their official parties, travels, security, and upkeep of their palaces, funds that anti-monarchists say could be spent on more urgent matters.
So why, for a family that already has so many riches, why don't they pay for that? You know, why does that come out of the public pocket? Because especially in this time where we need public funds for the cost of living crisis. I mean, we've got so many underfunded public services here.
I don't think it sets a good precedent for the way, like, taxpayers' money is spent. Give it to the NHS.
The National Public Service is not the only area that needs help. There's the deepening cost of living crisis, driven by soaring energy costs and an economy on the brink of recession.
People are going to suffer fuel poverty over this winter, and that without intervention of a fairly drastic nature, people are going to have to decide whether to heat their homes or to eat. Now, this seems a total obscenity in a nation which is one of the G6.
The British monarchy has an estimated wealth of more than $90 billion and privileges not available to the rest of the public.
We have Prince Charles, who is about to inherit the world's wealthiest woman's entire portfolio without an inheritance tax. That is a loss of literally hundreds of millions to the exchequer.
The past few months have seen multiple public sector strikes, mostly over pay, to keep up with the soaring cost of living that's pushing millions of people into poverty. It remains to be seen if the House of Windsor will continue to live on the public dime, and if so, what will the public do about it? Saeed Puraza, London.
That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Under the starry sky of the desert, from the very heart of evergreen forests, with the radiance of silver-coloured sand. In the midst of proud mountains, closer, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Drive a little bit slower. I want to see the city better.
Yes, madam. And don't forget to visit Chehel-Sutun Palace during your stay in Pazmin.
Sorry, sir, but you're kidding? Chehel-Sutun Monument is situated in Isfahan, not in Qazvin.
But we also have Chehel-Sutun here in Qazvin. We call it Chehel-Sutun Palace.
Oh, I didn't know that. I feel curious to see it. This Chehel-Sutun Palace. So, please give me a ride to this monument. One of the most important monuments of Safavid era is Chehel-Sutun or Kolah Farangi edifice in Qazvin, located in the middle of a large garden. This building is one of the remaining royal palaces of the Shah Tahmasp era. The building was known as Kolah Farangi when Qazvin was the capital in the Safavid dynasty. This edifice was rebuilt by Muhammad Baqir Sa'd al-Saltaneh, the governor of Qazvin in Qajar period, and it was named Chehel-Sutun in that time. Kolah Farangi edifice and Ali Qapu entrance gate are the only remained buildings from the Safavid era in Qazvin that is built in an octagonal building in two floors. The building has halls and small rooms on each floor, made too small in a plaid way and have very elegant and beautiful wooden windows. A porch with brick columns and semi-circular arcs cover the building, and a porch with wooden pillars has been built on top of it. Wall paintings on the first floor are samples of Qazvin Painting School with a global reputation. The walls, which are decorated with paintings, are unique in their kind. Now, at the Calligraphy Museum of Qazvin, this building is a place to keep the precious works such as calligraphies, old books, etc. The Chehel-Sutun Palace was registered as a national property in Iran's Cultural Heritage Organization in 1955.
Thank you. Well, I am now in the southern part of Azadi Square in Qazvin. Walking on a very nice looking sidewalk, which is adorned elegantly. And here's the entrance of Safavid Garden Complex, which has placed Chehel Sotun inside. Let me walk inside. Wow! A garden full of old, robust trees. Maybe each tree has its own story to tell. And here we have Chehel Sotun Palace of Qazvin, a gorgeous two-story octagonal building. A beautiful porch with brick pillars and semicircular arcs surround the monument, and a porch with wooden pillars is located above it. Well, this building is a remarkable example of the ancient history of Iran. Well, let me enter the first floor. This floor has a big hall with four rooms in four sides of it. The windows of this monument used to be open in the past. This let the fresh air come inside the building. However, today they are closed for the protection of the building. And what is interesting is that there used to be pools in the northern, southern, and central parts of the hall, which actually helped cooling of the air. Today, just the southern and central pools have remained and, of course, repaired. Amazing! Is part and parcel of Iranian culture. These walls, which are decorated with paintings, are unique. The wall paintings of the first floor are indicating the miniature art of the Qazvin school with global reputation. I am now in the second floor. As you may know, Qazvin is known as the capital of calligraphy of Iran due to having variety of prominent calligraphers. Therefore, this mansion was dedicated to Museum of Calligraphy in 2001, and art of calligraphers are on display in this museum. I'm really interested in calligraphy. Enjoy sweet memories in green space of the garden located in the palace. This palace is narrating part of art and history of Iran So don't hesitate and choose this attraction to create brilliant, everlasting moments for you and your companions. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss your problems, questions you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. A child is like a white paper on which you can write good things or bad things. Entire personality of a child is developed by the parents, by the upbringing they do. And in this program, we try to provide all the necessary information that is required to bring up your child in the best possible way. The answers of your questions are based upon Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. Today in our studio, we have had the pleasure to invite Professor Salma Nakavi, who is a faculty member of Al-Mustafa University and researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qom. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you very much.
Well, in our previous sessions, we have been discussing about the relationship, the domains of relationship. We discussed how we can detach a child from the digital world and develop his relationship with the environment. I would want you to give a brief of the previous sessions, and now then let's move on to the next topics.
Yes, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Supreme Absolute Being. We have been discussing the worldview that we as the followers of the faith should have. In this world of materialism, where it's very difficult to detach ourselves from the worldly attractions and things which keep us
busy
on the earth, basically, yeah. Yes?
The things that keep us busy all the time.
Busy all the time. Of course, we have to be busy all the time. But the important thing is, what is the intention? With what intention
with
are
what
we?
What you're going to be busy,
yes,
with.
And what are we targeting? And what, yeah, do we want to achieve? And this is very important, because when we, as I may have mentioned, that when we talk about the pure intention or sincerity in purpose, or we talk about the niyyah, it's not something that you just make when you're doing an action, when you're carrying out something. It's something which has a very deeper background in your mind. There's a whole worldview behind it. There's a whole ideology behind it. So therefore, we as human beings, and especially as parents, should know that what is our purpose and goal in life? What do we want to achieve?
Yeah.
And as we all say, that we want to achieve proximity to Allah Almighty.
True.
And I've been trying to define and to explain what does that proximity mean.
Yeah.
And proximity, of course, as we know, that it's not possible to gain a physical proximity to Allah Almighty because He's not a physical entity.
Yeah.
So in what are we becoming close to Him?
True.
You can be, you're close to someone in when you're a relative, you say you're close to him, or you live together, or you live close by, or some, and these are all physical things.
And now how you can get spiritually attached or close to someone, I'll ask you that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. We are with Professor Salman Nakavi, and we're discussing about Islamic upbringing, different topics. And Professor was discussing how we can develop spiritual relationship. Yes.
So basically, I've been emphasizing on the fact that we need to develop a relationship with Allah Almighty, and that is at two levels. One is at the level, at the higher level, which encloses it in it every aspect of our lives. And the special relationship which we have when we pray to Him, when we fast, when we go for Hajj, and such rituals that we carry out on a daily basis, on a weekly basis, on a monthly basis, on a yearly basis. These are special acts, spiritual acts that we carry out, where we get charged, where we get rejuvenated, recharged spiritually, to remain spiritual in all other spheres of life also.
Active, yeah.
Spiritually, and our attachment with Allah Almighty is re-entrenched during these spiritual experiences that we have. But that means that it should permeate, this spirituality should permeate all other aspects of our lives. And the four relationships which we are talking about, under the faith in Allah Almighty, under this umbrella, in this spiritual attachment which we have, come the four relationships. And one of them is the special relationship with Allah Almighty, but also the other relationships which we have, especially with other human beings.
Okay.
And the first and foremost relationship which begins for a human being is his attachment with his parents, or the parents with their children, their offsprings.
Yeah.
That's the primary relationship with other human beings which starts in this world.
Okay.
And especially for this relationship, we have to get prepared for ourselves. Number one, we have to establish that general relationship with Allah Almighty.
Yeah.
And that special relationship with Allah Almighty. And then, according to that worldview that we have, that we talk about saying, we need to become spiritually close to Him. We need to become competent to manage our relations.
All right.
And becoming competent requires knowledge and skills and attitude. The proper knowledge and the proper skills, and also the proper attitude.
Yeah.
And this skills, knowledge skill set varies from various relations to from one relationship to the other.
To other relationship, yeah.
Yes. I mean, when you want to pray to Allah Almighty, that requires a special set of knowledge and skills.
Yeah.
When you want to deal with human beings, that requires another knowledge.
Set of skills and knowledge. Yeah.
You can't say, look, I pray very nicely. I have a very good voice. When I pray to Allah, it's with sincerity. It's a beautiful voice, the best possible way. Mm-hmm. But that does not dispense with the fact we need to develop another set of knowledge and skills to deal with our children.
All right.
So what is the knowledge skill set that we require for children? We as parents, we're going for it's a new challenge in our lives.
Yeah. You're trying to say that in order to develop these set of relationships, we first must have knowledge plus skills. Exactly. Knowledge and skills are must. Parents have to educate themselves towards these set of skills so that they can guide their children as well. I'll talk more on that with you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam said, "He who recites the Quran before puberty has indeed been given wisdom in his childhood."
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. Professor said that we need to have those set of skills and knowledge ourselves as parents, and then only we can induce that to our children. Yes, Professor.
Yes, so number one, as I was saying, that under the umbrella of the general relationship with Allah Almighty, we need to become competent in every relationship, especially the relationship with our children. And for that, we have to develop the proper mindset. The world view that we have has to be very comprehensive. We have to understand that Allah Almighty, when He makes us become parents, when we come in, we're coming into that position, He is making us participate in the process of creation and creativity that He has for Himself. He is the supreme creator of everything. He has created the whole universe.
Yeah.
But then the universe has a certain system.
Yeah, set of rules.
Based on cause and effect.
True.
And everything doesn't happen out of the thin air. It happens according to a set of
rules
and laws.
Yeah.
And one of them is that the greatest creation of all, the human being himself, is himself a part of that creative process.
Yeah.
And so parents, by coming together, man and wife, are creating according to that system, according to that plan, according to that design.
Yeah.
They are becoming a part of that creation, that creative process. So that's a great, that's a huge, big honor for them. That Allah Almighty is giving them this
the
honor,
opportunity.
The honor, the dignity, the position
to be parents.
Therefore, that's one thing that we have to understand. And when this human, the third human being, is coming to into
their
existence, the person who is coming into this world, even before he or she is delivered out into this world, in the womb of the mother also, it is is a living creature.
Has its rights.
And has to be taken care of.
Yeah.
So as a trust that Allah Almighty is entrusting us with, as a ni'mah.
Yeah. So we said that we gave a gist of all what we have said so far. There are relationships that need to be developed in a child, and those relationships cannot be developed as such. For that, parents need to educate themselves with a set of skills, with a set of rules, and then only they can induce all those relationships, be that relationship with Allah, how to pray, how to act, how to go for fasting, be that relationship with their parents, be that relationship with other human beings, which we discussed in the previous sessions, or be that relationship with the environment, which is extremely necessary in these days because of the being attached to the digital world so much. Well, here once you said that now the parents have been honored with the parentship by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and now they have duties. Now, how parents can act as educators, we'll discuss that in another session, inshallah. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners, for listening to IRIB English Radio. In case you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please contact us at englishradio@irib.ir. You can also find us on social media platforms by just searching Call of Islam Radio or our official website, that's www.parstoday.com. Until another session, fi amanallah, God bless you all.
Do you know Islam says, it says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. Islam solves all of our problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
A grand jury has subpoenaed several associates of former President Donald Trump in connection with the Department of Justice's investigation into the origins of the January 6th Capitol riot. The Justice Department is looking into the Trump team's fundraising between the 2020 presidential election and 6th of January 2021 and how that money was used. That investigation is separate from the inquiry into the former president's handling of classified documents, which resulted in the FBI seizing material from his Mar-a-Lago residence last month. Stay with us for more. Britain's Guardian newspaper has this to say. Two of Donald Trump's top officials are facing subpoenas for an investigation against him regarding fundraisers following the 2020 elections that aimed to undermine the results of the election. Stephen Miller was once one of the former president's most senior aides, and Brian Jack, his former director of political affairs at the White House, were part of a large group of Trump officials and allies who were subpoenaed by the grand jury this week, according to a New York Times report. The current investigation is examining funds related to the Save America Political Action Committee, or Save America PAC, and an alleged plan that would entail sending fake electors to states that had contested results in the 2020 elections. The Save America Political Action Committee, or PAC, which was created by Trump in November of 2020, shortly after the election, is funded entirely by Republicans and currently sitting on more than $100 million in funds, up from $31 million in 2020. Stephen Miller, who attracted notoriety during Trump's administration for his alleged links to white supremacists and his staunch anti-immigrant stances, participated in a lengthy testimony earlier this year to the House Select Committee about Donald Trump's role in fanning the flames of the January 6 attack on the Capitol. Prior to that, in December, Brian Jack also faced a subpoena for his role in organizing a January 6 rally that led to the insurrection. Others on the list of the subpoenas issued this week include officials who were involved with the electoral scheme in various degrees, from junior aides to pro-Trump lawyers assisting in planning the scheme, as well as Republican lawmakers who are just Trump allies. While the subpoena doesn't put the individuals directly under investigation, it is an action that the Department of Justice can take against an individual in order to try to garner further information in a case, according to the New York Times. This week's subpoena is only the latest in a long string of allegations against an investigation of the former president. In the most recent episode, a raid in his Mar-a-Lago, Florida estate revealed he was in possession of documents he took from the White House during his departure in 2021. Documents that even senior Biden aides did not have the access to view. In response, Donald Trump last week chided the FBI and Department of Justice, accusing them of being vicious monsters under the control of the media and radical left scoundrels. CBS News has covered the story from a different angle. A grand jury has subpoenaed several associates of former President Donald Trump in connection with the Department of Justice's investigation into the origins of the January 6th Capitol riot. Multiple people familiar with the case told CBS News. It is not yet clear how many subpoenas were issued. The Justice Department is looking into the Trump team's fundraising activities between the 2020 presidential election and 6th of January 2021, and how that money was used. That investigation is separate from the inquiry into the former president's handling of classified documents, which resulted in the FBI seizing materials from his Mar-a-Lago residence last month. The Department of Justice's probe of the attack on the Capitol has accelerated over the last week. William Russell, a close advisor to Donald Trump, received a subpoena on Wednesday, 7th of September, related to the investigation. William Russell, 31, was often seen by Donald Trump's side, serving as the White House Deputy Director of Advance and Trip Director. He was with the former president for part of the day of the riot and moved to Florida to continue working for Donald Trump after his presidency. FBI personnel visited William Russell's Florida home for questioning on Wednesday morning, but he was out, according to a person familiar with the matter. Investigators later reached him by phone and served a subpoena via email. A lawyer for William Russell, Derek Ross, did not reply to a request for comment. William Russell, a Mississippi native, started working at the White House in 2017. A spokesperson for Trump criticized the investigation, claiming the Justice Department was attempting to intimidate the former president's supporters. It will not work. Save America is more committed than ever to working for liberty, free and fair elections, equal justice under the law, strong borders, safe streets, energy independence, great education and more, said Liz Harrington, the spokesperson. The Business Insider has more details about the story. Two top former Trump advisors were subpoenaed this week as part of the Justice Department's expansive investigation into the events around the January 6th Capitol riot and beyond. Stephen Miller, a senior policy advisor during the Trump White House, and Brian Jack, Trump's political director, were among more than a dozen people in the former president's circle who were subpoenaed by a federal grand jury this week. Stephen Miller and Brian Jack did not immediately respond to a request for comment. The subpoenas appear to seek information on Trump's main fundraising operation, Save America, which was formed after the 2020 election and the alleged plot to overturn the 2020 vote by sending a slate of fake electors to contested states. On Thursday, the New York Times also reported that the Department of Justice is looking into the Save America PAC based on about a half a dozen subpoenas to lower-level former Trump aides, including Nicholas Luna and Ivanka Trump's chief of staff, Julie Radford. It remains unclear why exactly the Save America PAC is being investigated and how it might relate to the Capitol riot. The subpoenas for Stephen Miller and Brian Jack are also related to the Trump PAC, as well as the 2020 electoral scheme. On top of the ongoing probe of Trump's handling of official government records, the Department of Justice is investigating the Capitol breach, any obstruction of that investigation, and the fake electors' plot. Stephen Miller was subpoenaed by the House Select Committee investigating January 6th for his phone records earlier this year. The Trump advisor filed a lawsuit to block the subpoena, CNN reported. He previously sat for a deposition with the panel. Brian Jack, who still advises Donald Trump, was also subpoenaed by the committee last year.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.